right into the mic. Hello, can everybody hear me? Can you hear me on Butler Street? Good. All right, we're going to get started. We're going to try to get started here. Come on in. So, hey, welcome to Hemingway's at Hop Farm. Thank you for coming out. Just a little bit of housekeeping. If you want a beer, if you want some food, you can either order from Herb at the bar out front or use those handy QR code things in your phones, which I've never actually been able to do. But you can try it and you might succeed. So give yourself a challenge tonight. Thanks so much for coming out. It's the Hemingway's Summer Poetry Series 50th anniversary season. So we're very excited about that and to be in a new venue that's wide open and spacious and makes their own beer. So thanks for coming out. We really appreciate it. So Hemingway started 50 years ago. We're pretty sure. I mean, Jimmy always told me 1974. We've heard tale that maybe that's not exactly pinpoint accurate, but we're poets, so we strive for emotional accuracy, not facts. So emotionally, it feels true that this has been 50 years. So this was started, we were talking earlier, Joan and I, with Christy Graver over there from Pittsburgh Magazine, that the series started because we believe Bruce Dobler, who taught at Pitt, had the idea that there should be a summer reading series in the city and that it shouldn't be affiliated with any of the university programs or any of the particular writing groups in town. Essentially non-denominational, so Jimmy Savedic was tapped to run it, and he did it until 5 years ago when he passed away. So it's been a long-running gig, and we're just really happy to be here and happy to see everybody. I'm going to read one of Jimmy's poems. I'm going to try to read one of Jimmy's poems. I could just read you the title and walk off like Jimmy did. But what I loved about Jimmy's poetry was that it can be really rough and profane. He loved a good swear. He loved a good joke. But Jimmy at heart was a moralist, and he lived many lives in the life that he had. And it's all in his poetry, his Catholic education and upbringing with his mother, his time serving in the military in Vietnam, his time on the police force working as a homicide detective and an undercover narcotics detective, as a boxing coach, and really opening gyms to help at-risk youth, to give them focus and real purpose and direction. The toy drives, I mean, Jimmy did so much that, you know, it's easy for the poetry that he wrote to kind of get lost in that shuffle. But I think it really was the center of the whole package. And the more of his poetry that I read, the more clear that becomes for me. And I miss Jimmy very much. I wish he was here. This is called Bones to Chimes. I dug Bukowski up and took some of Chinaski's ribs. Didn't really care about his gravestone. Two boxers squared off. Don't even try. Then I went to find Bandini's bones. Broke off a couple of fingers. If you don't believe me, just ask the dust. Then I went to South America, found where they buried Neruda, and broke off a piece of his jawbone, took a couple of his teeth, and yelled, "Residents on Earth, my ass!" I then made my way up to Concord, found the grave of Henry David, and I dug him up with my hands out of quiet desperation. I took his femur and a couple of spine bones. I saved enough money and went to England and found Shakespeare's grave. Didn't care about the curse. I took his skull and an old yellow scroll manuscript. I went to my writing room, got a piece of fishing line and sewed Janaski's ribs, Bandini's fingers, Neruda's jawbone and teeth, Henry David's femur, and Shakespeare's skull. It took several decades to sew the bones, but it was missing sound. So I went to New Jersey. That's where you laugh, right? The New Jersey, right? And dug up Whitman and snapped off his toes one by one. I went home and tied Whitman with the other bones, and then I went outside next to the large evergreen and tied the bone wind chime. It sounded like the most beautiful war ever waged. It sounded like the horn of Gabriel. It sounded like Cleo and Anthony merging Egypt and Rome. It smelled like the moat of a castle that Joan had scaled for the freedom of France, to the screams of a throng watching a saint being burnt to death. It tasted of the liver of a gazelle killed by a lion, the bones crashing into each other like the waves of Big Sur. The chime called for Hemingway and Cervantes. I sat on the step of my porch and thanked them for sound and magic and thought of Twain and the mighty Mississippi. And I said, the gods have been good. And I fell into a sleep, dreaming of Milton's eyes. Thanks. Thanks for coming. I will turn you over to Joan Bauer.
Thank you. It really helps to speak directly into the mic, be right on top of it. Hey, thank you all for coming out tonight. You know, we had a little trepidation, you know, new venue, new season. Will they come? And here you all are, and it is, we're thrilled to be here. It is a wonderful venue and a great meeting place for us. And I hope you'll tell your friends about this series, because we always want to encourage more people to come out, because among those people are sometimes people who don't know too much about poetry, and you give them a little exposure to all the poetry can be. And how about it? Suddenly you've got a few more poets. They're scribbling off in the corner. You never know. Tonight we will be having 5 featured readers. We will have also an open mic. As a reminder to the readers, after the features, we're going to do the photo, the group photo, very important, so that it can appear along with your readings on Hemingway's blog. And you folks can go back and listen to poets who read 10 or 15, yeah, actually about 10 or 12 or 14 years ago when we were at Hemingway's. And we will have an open mic, and at the break, you can come up, and if you wish, I think we've got five slots, so if you'd like to read a poem or two tonight, that would be great, okay? This is so cool. Our first reader tonight is Jan Beatty, whose 8th book, Drag Stripping, is forthcoming from University of Pittsburgh Press. As you know, Jan worked as a waitress and abortion counselor in a maximum security prison. She is professor emerita at Carlo University, where she directed the creative writing program, the Mad Women, and the MFA program. And she just won an award for this wonderful poem in Copernickel. And I saw that online. I just want to mention it. It is thrilling to begin with Jan Beatty. Please welcome Jan Beatty.
I think so. Yeah. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this is exciting. Thanks, Joan. And thanks, Chris. I know you had to do a lot to make this happen. I don't know what it was, but I'm sure, sure it was a lot. So thank you. And I'm really excited to read with Fred and Ben, and who I just realized was my student. Well, he told me he was my student 20 years ago. And wow. So, and Amy Lee Halley. So this is extra exciting. So I thought I'd read a couple of new poems. This first poem is for Ed Ochester. After I found out that Ed died, I was supposed to do a reading in Atlantic City a couple days after that. And I didn't really want to go, and because I was upset, like all of us were. The reading went pretty well, but on the way home, I was in the Philadelphia airport, and I started crying in the airport, like a lot. And I was leaning up against the wall in the airport and just crying and crying. And, you know, I didn't want to be crying, but I was. And so I called Don and I said, "What should I do?" And he said, "Get something to eat." That's always his answer for everything. And it's not a bad answer. And so I got a big hoagie and this big bottle of water for $21 at the Philadelphia Airport. And that night I had this dream. And this is the dream that I had. It's called Directions After Dying. If you want to find the resting stop between worlds, go to Rapid City, North Dakota, not south. You'll see a flagpole on a hill with a jacket flying in the wind, a lightweight polyester, the kind that flies sideways. You can put your jacket there. That's the whole thing. That's what I mean. I don't really know what it means exactly, but it was a dream. And it felt real. You know those dreams that feel real. So I got a past life reading at this rock shop in Point Breeze called Ceremonial. That's the rock shop. And I wasn't intending to get a past life reading, but I just did. And this is about that. Riding shotgun with my body. I passed the Bang Bang Salon after a past life reader told me I was the eldest son of a family in the late 1700s. It was a wagon wheel death. She said I was a star seed from another place. I turned the corner to Bottom Feeder Books, said, "I just had a past life reading. I'm feeling a little floaty." Ryan at Bottom Feeders said, "Okay, feel free to look around." I was riding shotgun with my body on the lookout for bandits holding my strong box of fire messages. I opened Camino Road to page 65. I've been preoccupied with eruption today. Well, yes, every time I touch it. Nikki the reader had said, "Name the spirit on your shoulder and rename it when you grow, from ex-rebel killer to wild empowered dragon." Ryan has a great smile. I bought Camino Road by Rene Green and Gasoline by Corso. "Take a sword and slash away the unneeded parts of the past," Nikki said. There was a tiara in my tarot reading and a hunk of malachite in my pocket. I was awake in my dream discussing the dream of rocket ships. I almost bought Love is a Pie, but got dinner instead. So I'm going to read a poem from Sky Dog, which is my chapbook that was published by Lefty Blondie Press. And you probably know that Amy Lee Hineland, sitting over there, who's going to read soon, is the editor and publisher of Lefty Blondie, along with Marguerite Sargent. And it's a great press, and you need to go online and read about it and submit to it. And I'm so honored to be a part of it. So I'm going to read a poem here. The Drawbridge. Spelling and grammar want me to use bulkheads instead of fuckheads. And although I like bulk, there's nothing like the smack of a fuckhead. Like Jack White, who says technology is a big destroyer of emotion and truth. I dream of sledgehammering computers, jumping on them, then throwing the detritus out the window, feeling my own gunfire, because who wants a watered-down heart? People call me dark, but a world without dark is just half a world. I know you understand. There's a bridge between us. Can you see it? Didn't you ever want to tear something down, smash it, to make the parts talk their battered talk, the stabbing edges and burning colors, the love compressed in the steel beam and the raging yellow flame. I've been dead 1,000 years, and I never tired of the dying waving me away, that last hand lifted between them and me, that raised drawbridge of power, that sweet breeze of that's enough. So I have this is the galleys for my new book, Drag Stripping. I don't have any to sell or give you, but I thought I would read one poem from here, a title poem, which actually was the one online, but it has a new name now. So this is the title poem, Drag Stripping. So there's a lot of different kinds of drag in here. Drag as in being held back, drag as in drag strip, drag as in drag club, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to buy the book. But drag stripping. I met a stripper on my first visit to the Big West. Sitting on a hill in Marin, I was wearing a black, red, yellow plaid shirt. She wore something more open, loose, sleeveless. Her knees to her chest, she was pulling at the brown California grass, throwing it back down. I loved looking at her plain brown hair falling over the side of her face. I was still wearing women's clothes and shoes, but I made myself a believer that day. Her thick belt, heavy boots, brown eyes. The way she looked at me until I had to look away. She was boy, and I hadn't met anyone like her yet. Look at her blue shirt. She opened me the way she tore at the grass hard, then threw it. We walked the hills in Marin. I wanted to be like her. I wanted to be her. I couldn't even say what she had, but I wanted it. Our time lasted only weeks, but her face still comes to me. I made myself a queen that day. Inside, I felt the turning diamonds of a life not lived, someone else's life, now mine. Holding the vision heavy as mud, I thought, just a push into my bleeding heart. I could feel the brass screws of the rail's underside, a train running without me. I could feel the spikes and the crosscuts, and I came alive in the fading light and the sky full of birds. And I did, and it was fierce and wild and back to the wall scary. It was off on whenever she was there. I was a blank slate with a hard body. It was everything I wanted. Someone to kiss me nice and slow, then slam me onto the ground's body. It would be years until I knew her, knew that part of me as I searched the secondhand stores for men's clothing, men's size 7 shoes, looking for the boy man in me. I don't believe in salvation, but look at her body stripping, jerking to one side, head bent. Hair covers her face, breasts large and moving, her thickness wet with boy sweat between her legs, a strip shot across a pitch black stage, flash of a woman running her show. However she wants you, she can have you. Half of a whole body stripping for you, the body divided against itself in beauty. I made myself a man watching her. The strip shot breaks apart into millions of shut back stars, cutting the night apart in her cross-cut body, hard and lovely. Some people say half isn't anything, but it will drive an ocean back to the center. She'll take your money and you'll thank her in the cage of your body, drowning in the stripping, loving the shut back body, dear ghost of everything you wanted, jerking you into pleasure, jerking you into your own story with a strip shot of ammo to the vulva, triangle of light, triangle of her, the wrapper, three sides of lust, the fuck field, the fourth eye. I saw the future in her body, but I didn't know my questions. All that came out of my mouth were birds. Thank you.
Now, I want to direct your attention right now to the table over here, which has books on it. And my partner, Don Sturick, with the hat on, is standing there behind the table. And after the readings, there are going to be books for sale. And so I don't want you to walk out of here without having a chance to purchase some of those books. Okay, just to make sure you're with us on this. Okay. Our next reader tonight is Ben Gwynn, the author of the novel Clean Time and the book Team Building, a memoir about family and the fight for workers' rights. He is the editor of the anthology Pittsburgh Neighborhood Guidebook. He lives in Pittsburgh with his child, and it is great to have you reading for Hemingway's. Here is Ben.
All right, is that working? Wonderful. I'm going to read a couple chapters from the middle of the memoir that I wrote that came out last year. This chapter is titled School. May 2019. On Friday, around lunchtime, I got an email from Gracie's school saying that she had 3 D's halfway through the marking period and would need to complete a large backlog of assignments to get her grades up by the end of the year. I felt horrible. I'd been so focused on the union and work that I completely ignored her grades. She'd always been on the honor roll in elementary school. The year before, she had slipped a bit after her mother's death, but I gave her a pass. This year, though, she fell behind and was running out of time to get caught up. I snuck out of work early. I went home and cleaned her room. I scraped melted candy wrappers off the floor behind the radiator and swept up empty chip bags. I gathered and sorted piles of dirty clothes and put away her toys, most of which she hadn't played with in years, though her bed was still full of stuffed animals. I went grocery shopping, got dinner ready, and then picked her up from the Boys and Girls Club. I said, "You need to do your homework," and she said, "Sorry, Dad." After dinner, we sat down on the couch in the living room and got ready to go over all the homework she was missing. "I'm sorry," she said, "I can't keep track of everything." And I said, "When I asked you if your homework was done, you said yes." And she said, "I'm sorry." I said, "I'll help you, but you have to tell me you need help." We sat together and worked through her problems. She had a bunch of creative writing assignments due that we'd have to finish up over the weekend. We went subject by subject, and we almost got caught up. Gracie had also been late a few times the previous year and had missed a handful of days. I'd let her stay home if she said she wasn't up for it. I didn't think it helped anyone to be overly hard on her after everything she'd been through. I was searching for a therapist for her, but it took forever to find someone who accepted my insurance and worked with kids. UPMC put us on a waiting list, but they said it would be months before she could see someone. When we were almost finished, I said, "Listen, you won't be able to do this in high school, and if you want to go to college, you're going to need to get good grades and get scholarships because I can't afford to pay for it." I sat up and rubbed my eyes. I regretted being so blunt. "I know," she said. And I said, "You're smart. Just do the work. Do as much of it as you can in class." "I do," she said. She turned off her laptop and we played the new Mario Brothers game I'd bought her for Christmas. For the next couple hours, we jumped and fireballed our way through a few levels while Gracie played pop music on her phone. It was as much quality time as we got together. "Is everything all right?" I asked. And she said, "I'm tired of people calling me brave. I don't want to be brave. I want my mom." She spoke very matter-of-factly. "I know," I said, "it's not fair." And she said, "I remember my mom falling a lot and going to all these weird people's houses. It's so messed up. I don't know why she did it." "She thought she had to," I said. "When you're addicted to drugs, you do things you wouldn't normally. Why did she do heroin in the first place?" Gracie asked, and I said, "I don't know." Jane told me once about the first time she shot dope. The way she described it, it was just another random night with her boyfriend after a Bob Weir show. But after that night, she said, heroin was all that mattered. Nothing else would do it for her. She was still in high school. I thought about the randomness of her addiction and of my own sobriety, grateful that I'd never tried heroin, while Gracie and I warped to a water level. We swam around in penguin suits and shot ice balls at pixelated fish and squid. "Your mom loved you," I said. "She was really funny when she wasn't on drugs." "Did you break up with her because of the drugs?" Gracie asked. And I said, "Basically, but it was more complicated than that." Gracie sat quietly and didn't respond. We played a little while longer, and then it was time for her to go to bed. I stayed up late watching TV, worrying about her and unsure of how to help. May 2019, under the lights. Now, this is like the 5-year anniversary of all this shit. That's fucking rad. Gracie's first game with her new ninth ward team was a doubleheader way down in Oakdale. We made the opening day trip 35 minutes west on an unseasonably cold morning in late spring. "I wish I could play fast pitch," Gracie said. And I said, "That'd be fun." For some reason, there wasn't recreational fast pitch softball for little girls in the city of Pittsburgh. All I found online were travel teams in the suburbs, and those cost thousands of dollars and would require thousands more for gas and lodging costs. Gracie wasn't a prodigy, but she was a good hitter and she enjoyed playing. Mostly she liked the social aspect of it, but it was fun to watch her develop a competitive streak too. "I like this team more," she said. "We are better than Shadyside." And I said, "Well, most of the girls have been playing longer." We got to the game. The field was at the bottom of a big hill with a path that wound around the dugouts and snack bar. I sat behind the fence in right field and watched Gracie's team lose the first game by almost 20 runs and the second game by 10. They were overmatched, but at least they kept it close for a few innings in game two. I wondered why Oakdale was even on the schedule, and I was glad we wouldn't have to make that long trip again. Gracie played pretty well, though, and wasn't too upset on the ride home. "They hit the ball so far," she said. And I said, "They must all be 12. We sat in silence for a bit. Rides home were much more fun after victories when we could recount all her team's hits and good plays instead of how many home runs the other team had hit. We stopped at Wendy's on the way back. That summer, we spent most of our nights under the lights at softball fields across Allegheny County. Gracie had softball practice or a game 5 nights a week. The team that I coached was not very competitive, but it was still fun. Going to the Ninth Ward games and watching was much more relaxing, and they won almost half their games. Gracie also played up a division when Ninth Ward's 15 and under team was short players. This was mostly due to us living close to the field and being available on short notice, but she held her own as an 11-year-old against the older kids. When Gracie didn't have softball games, I played baseball. And once the school year was over, she'd come watch. After games, she'd tell me the same things about my swing that I told her about hers. "You need to stay back, Dad." "I know, honey." I've been trying to develop some late career power and mostly failing. I still got on base enough to be an effective bottom of the order hitter in our mid-level adult league. In a short season, though, it's possible to do everything right and still not put up good numbers if the ball doesn't find the gaps. But it usually evens out. Working on the process, pitch recognition, staying on plane, and making better contact is still worthwhile to me, even if it results in mostly singles. That summer, my team had another good regular season and an early playoff exit. The satisfaction of hitting a ball on the barrel with a wood bat in my late 30s is amazing, but it's nothing compared to watching Gracie do well in a game. I was proud, sure, but I was also happy that she was happy. Happiness had been in such short supply for both of us. Her first double of the season came in a night game against Reserve Township. She hit a line drive down the left field line that cleared the bases. They lost, but it was close, and I could see all the extra practice was paying off. She became a dependable hitter and moved up in the batting order. On a dry day at the field in Lawrenceville, right down the street, which doesn't have a fence, she put one in between the outfielders and ran around the bases for a home run. We'd stop for fast food after away games and talk about how she did and how the team looked overall. We talk about hitting, one of my favorite things. It was precious time together, and we grew closer. Those moments were fleeting, though, and I knew it. When high school started and she became more independent, we would have less time like this together. I still regretted not appreciating playing baseball games that mattered, and the summer days I spent with my dad when I was a teenager. I had mostly forgiven myself for being a stupid kid who didn't realize how good he had it, but sometimes that regret turned into deep remorse. I didn't want to have similar regrets about not spending time with my daughter. I put a lot of pressure on myself to be a good dad. The weight I felt I needed to carry lessened during the summer months. I don't know if I appreciated the time more because Jane had just died and I felt it was even more important to be there for my kid. Maybe I felt too self-satisfied with just doing normal dad stuff, clearing a very low bar by very little. I was constantly overthinking things, but I knew Gracie was happy when she hit a double or made a catch at third base. I could see that joy. I equated that joy with me doing something right, or at least not getting in the way. Maybe my view of it is all too self-centered, and I don't really matter that much, but I wanted her to know I was trying. In the smaller moments, when the cloud of her mother's death wasn't as dark and didn't loom so heavily, we could just enjoy our time together, and it felt great. I wasn't thinking about myself. I was thinking about Gracie and how much I loved her. I hoped she'd carry that with her. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. It's wonderful. Thank you. Amy Lee Heinlein is a poet and publisher. She is the author of the chapbook All Else Falls to Shadow. Her poetry are published in a number of journals, and she is the co-founder and editor of Lefty Blondie Press an independent publisher promoting the work of self-identifying women and non-binary poets, and I always am so happy. I love this little bit of bio here. And she was honored with the Best Thesis in Poetry Prize from Chatham University. Yes! Please welcome Amy Lee Hyland.
Hi. Okay, can you hear me? Okay, I feel like everybody, we all need to like get our wiggles out. Okay. I'm so excited to be up here tonight. It's been a while since I've read my own work. I've been really focused on the Lefty Blondie Press and all of the amazing things we're getting to do in the Pittsburgh area and nationally. So thanks to Joan and Chris for inviting me to read with this spectacular lineup of authors. As I was reading the bios, I noticed we represent poetry, fiction, and nonfiction tonight. And it got me thinking about the line, and this is debatable if there is one, between fictional characters and the speakers in poems, and how I seem to be writing a life story that is a little bit mine, of course, but many I've not lived but like to imagine. So anyway, that's what guided my poem choices this evening, so we'll see how they fit together. Some are in my chapbook, All Else Falls to Shadow, and some are in my yet-to-be-published full-length. So, I forgot to start my timer. Okay. Believer's Assembly. My mother knew hell as an address on earth, a street with a room where she used to live. Once, on Easter Sunday, she played first witness to the resurrection. At some silent cue, she leapt from the wooden pew with her message, "Praise Jesus." Mary Magdalene took over my mother. Her tongue trilled and hummed with the Holy Spirit. Hum de la hum. Beautiful, these women made weak by the world. My mother, full of Mary, was fierce. She walked the aisle, delivering the good news, tears streaming down her face. He has risen. We sang Old Rugged Cross while Pastor Shackelford laid hands on the sick, reminded us how Jesus needs to be invited in. How she'd learned, hum de la hum, she would never tell me. Need that anymore. Jesus cast out her seven demons. Later, she anointed his filthy feet, calloused and cracked, with the amber oil of muskroot, washed the dust from them with her hair, wiped them clean. I have seen the Lord, she shouted in that sanctuary, his empty tomb. So, being raised Pentecostal, I'm definitely interested in sort of what drives people towards religion or just, trying on different things in a way to sort of find a higher plane. So, this actually comes from a writer's almanac from June 24th, 2011, called St. Vitus Dance, 1374. And I had never heard of it before I had heard this writer's almanac. So the title comes from that, and the rest is mine. Some experienced aversions to the color red and to pointy-toed shoes. It started with a hum. Unchecked, it spread. Sometimes whole hamlets for days, then months, danced until death or broken and no longer able to flap or leap, rear and buck. Alms were collected, musicians paid to mellow and soothe the dancers. Soon, their chairs were abandoned. Wood and strings of beloved instruments, trampled and twisted, musicians joined up in the jigs. Prayers went up to St. Vitus. Hum de la hum, please take back this frantic curse. After prayers, exorcisms, solitary confinement. She kept to classics, swirling, well-practiced circles, pausing only to adjust her headdress, tear off her binding. When her heart seized up, her hands flocked to her chest. The dancers kept dancing. Then they stopped. Researchers say economic hardship, ergot poisoning, cults, mass hysteria. But what of the bent cobbler pushing his cart from town to town, humming his peculiar, catchy little tune? What of the pointy red shoes, little devil's pitchforks? She could not dance from her feet. Thank you. I've also been writing a lot of self-portraits as. I feel like it's a way for me to deal with gender and other issues I don't necessarily know how to tackle directly. So, self-portrait is Noah. When the rain came, I had been dry for weeks. When the land became an ocean to lift my boat, I just wanted to relax with a nice bottle of red. Just a taste to help ignore the mewling, moaning, and stomping, that damn zebra who ate the oleander. My thirst, an ocean to drown out the pounding, the pleading after I secured the door. Okay. So another thing I write a lot about is motherhood. And actually, my daughter's in the back. Hi, Eleanor. Yay! I think it's really important to bring your kids to things like this, so. But these next two poems are sort of in direct opposition of one another, and that's one of the things I love that poetry gets to do, is each poem can directly contradict each other and still be in the same book and live in the same world. Grind. Waxy shades of purple streak yellow construction paper. She grins up at me. I ooh la la. I slide pasta into boiling water. I place our warped wooden spoon across the pot. I wait. I have things to do. Droplets polka dot my open notebook. Her fat hands work to seize my pen, my paper. Her artwork is sovereign, too sprawling for one yellow sheet, too vibrant for the tincture of crayons. She takes what she needs. I have forgotten. At lunch, secure in her high chair, she forks rotini into her mouth. Her budding teeth scissor with soft twists. Olive oil and saliva glisten down her chin. She laughs through her mouthful of pasta. She does as she pleases. I try to use my teeth for something other than grinding against themselves. I try to accept this time as enough. I gobble noodles, scribble notes, make funny faces until her pixie giggle rings around us. How much longer until anything else? She throws all she can reach to the floor. Well, my phone went off, so I don't know how I'm doing on time. So two more, and then I'm out of here. All right, in bad taste. But worse than politics on Thanksgiving, that cranberry tone of self-righteousness matching my aunt's third glass of Merlot, or that neighbor from three doors down, this year's pity feed, yammering loudly, sweet potatoes or yams, gas or electric, Steelers or Ravens, cloth or paper. arrives joy, unabashed. Showing up on this page meant for tough, salty mouthfuls. I bliss in the jubilation of clean laundry folded, put away neatly, pumpkin roll baking in the oven, that rare November sunlight illuminating what's left of the fiery leaves. But as if detailing my perineum tear or comparing cesarean scars and how much giving birth fucking hurts, while my sister-in-law opens saccharine gifts at her first baby shower, my small stakes elation is met with silence. But for the scrape of silverware across great grandma's china as creamed corn is pushed under the dark meat. Okay. Sunday morning flannel sheets. Excuse me, Saturday morning flannel sheets. I don't know what day of the week it is. Okay. Because I say the exact wrong thing, my daughter is sobbing. I don't want to grow up. I don't want you to die. I don't want to die. She's 5. Her tongue jimmies, her first tooth loose from its warm bottom gum. This necessary severing can't come without a little wiggle and push, a little blood. I snuggle my little girl, knowing this is a memory we are tooling. Let it nestle. I tell her someday she won't want this, to cuddle with me under warm flannel on a chilly Saturday morning. It's the exact wrong thing, but it's the tug we remember. Her tears, like loose milk teeth, like my own necessary blood, like someday her own. Thank you.
Now, can you all hear pretty well back there? How are you doing back there? Okay? Okay, great. Hallie Pritz is a writer from Western Pennsylvania. Her fiction is equal parts romp and social commentary with eccentric characters, class struggles, changing ecology, an ever uncertain future, and the defining question of what it means to be free. Pretty relevant, yeah. Her work is in McSweeney, Points and Case, The Fourth River, and she is a reader for the Barcelona Review. Please welcome Hallie.
Hi. So I'm going to read 3 short pieces. Thank you. Tonight, and somehow 2 of them are about real estate. I apparently have a lot of big feelings about real estate, but like looking out here, I recognize some like old Pittsburghers, so I feel like you might share these strong feelings about real estate. So this first piece was published in McSweeney's last year, about a year ago. And it's about the very American, the new American dream of someday being rich enough to move back to the old neighborhood you used to live in. and my own personal secret title for it is Someday Honey Will Be Rich Enough to Move Back to Bloomfield. This is called Someday Sarah, Our Ship Will Come In and We'll Move Back to the Neighborhood We Used to Live In Before We Got Priced Out. Someday, Sarah, our ship will come in, and I'll buy you a diamond as big as your eye and a mink coat to rival any movie star. And then, Sarah, I'll move us back to the neighborhood we used to live in before we got priced out. Just imagine, Sarah, our own row house, the very same one we rented for 5 years for $700 per month before the owner evicted us to sell to a developer. Only this time, Sarah, the shag carpets will have been replaced with the finest and most homogeneous gray composite flooring. It will be so easy to clean, Sarah, and so neutral it will offend no one. Just think, Sarah, soon we'll be sitting on our old back stoop, and instead of hearing a domestic dispute, we'll be deafened by the roar of the newly yet shoddily installed central air unit. Just imagine it, Sarah. You, me, and the neighborhood we lived in for years but could no longer afford. What do you think it will be like, Sarah? Will the streets be paved with gold? Will they at least have filled the pothole that once ripped the tire off your car? Perhaps they've even dealt with a rat problem. Or maybe they've retrained the rats. They're exceptionally smart creatures. To tutor children so they have the best chance of getting into the neighborhood's highly rated preschool. You remember that preschool, Sarah? The one that went in down the street from our rental, and we looked at it, and then each other, and said, "Oh, fuck," in unison. Because, Sarah, we knew what that meant. But Sarah, when our ship comes in, it will all be different. And by different, I mean the exact same place we used to live, but with like slightly better restaurants and different kinds of crime. Imagine us in the old neighborhood with enough money to live in our old house and hire the most promising retrained rats to tutor our future children. I can almost see our darlings Sarah Jr. and Clarence set up in what used to be that shitty pantry where the shelves would fall if you put too many cans on them. But now that pantry has new drywall and is called a breakfast nook. And our future children are sat there with two of the most sought-after rat tutors learning the Pythagorean theorem. Imagine it, Sarah. I dare say, Sarah, that I might even be able to go for a run in my shortest shorts without that guy who rides a bike only because he got a DUI calling me a queer. And not in the cool, reclaimed way, Sarah. For that DUI bike man left the old neighborhood shortly after we did. And yes, Sarah, it is pure irony that he also moved to our new neighborhood. But someday, Sarah, our ship will come in and he won't be there to shout homophobic slurs or comment on your tits, Sarah. And on that golden day, we'll take advantage of all the little eateries and boutiques that have popped up since we were forced to leave, even the ones that seem like they don't want to sell you anything, but instead just curate like three types of vegan macarons, two shirts without price tags, and a jade plant. We will convince them to sell us some of those macarons, Sarah. And they will be delicious. Yes, Sarah, I cannot wait for that day, you and me and our future children returning to the old neighborhood like we never left, except that we won't know anyone because all our friends were forced out too. But no matter, when our ship comes in, we'll make new friends, probably with the parents from that fancy preschool. What's that, Sarah? What's that you're reading in the newspaper? Amazon is considering putting a new headquarters in the old neighborhood? Well, fuck me, Sarah, we're screwed. Thanks. So this next one is another piece of satire. It's not about real estate. But don't worry, there's another one of those. many of you, unfortunately, will probably relate. This was also a McSweeney's piece, and it's called "As the oldest person in this American Eagle store, what's my duty in the event of an active shooter?" It's hard not to notice I'm the only person with crow's feet in this American Eagle, but what can I say? I joined their mailing list in the 90s, back when it was actual mail, and they still haven't kicked me off. Honestly, I'm not sure if I can wear mom jeans ironically or if the double irony cancels itself out, but I don't care. I'm just here for their comfy yet butt-enhancing denim. But as I browse, I barely have time to consider if I'm too old for this wholesome yet sexy college girl aesthetic, because I'm also thinking, where's the exit in this place? And if the report of semi-automatic weapons echoes through the mall, will I, as the oldest person here, have the moral responsibility to lead everyone to safety? Of course, this isn't the only place I question my responsibility to shield the public from some crazed man-child carrying weapons of war. I have to make this call every time I visit a Whole Foods or Dollar General, a barbecue or ribbon-cutting ceremony, the symphony or a demolition derby, a Dave Matthews Band concert or a Coen Brothers movie. It's just that usually I'm not the oldest person involved, so I've got comrades in arms. If racks of hoodies or loaves of organic bread or a box of Milk Duds could be considered arms. On my way to the fitting room, I make sure to scope out the stock room since, in the event of a near military assault on the mall, Lord knows these kids won't have the foresight to take cover behind the winter shipment of adorable new woolly hats and cozy mittens that haven't been put out yet. American Eagle's target market, according to the internet, is 15 to 25-year-olds, which makes me confident I'm the oldest person to try on this super cute jumper and cements my responsibility during an act of domestic terrorism at a suburban mall. Side issue, do these overalls make my butt look flat? A mom walks in with her tween while I'm checking out the stock of bralette tops that will offer little support to my adult frame. Finally, a partner. Should the worst happen, she and I can team up in an unstoppable wall of elder millennialhood and barricade the entrance with racks of throwback bomber jackets. That or die trying, which actually seems pretty likely. Never mind, her daughter just called her a bitch and now she's dragging the kid out of here. I'm on my own again. I suppose the two ponytailed cashiers also have some sort of duty to protect? Perhaps they'll step up if a 16-year-old carrying assault weapons shoots his way past the 25% off undies sign. But honestly, who could blame a pair of teenagers for failing to martyr themselves? Me, however, this is my second go-round with flannel shirts and flare jeans. I'd have no choice but to take charge. Come to think of it, teens get a lot of school training for this scenario, a crazed gunman bursting in and killing a bunch of people for fun. So maybe we can band together Red Dawn style to thwart the domestic terrorists. And yeah, referencing 1984's Red Dawn, starring Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey, just reinforces that I'm definitely the oldest person here. Flattering high-rise jeans notwithstanding. All right, I've made my purchases of the comfortable yet trendy clothing that's kept me coming back for decades. Someone else will have to take my place as the most ethically responsible person in the store. I was thinking of stopping at Talbot's on my way home, but as the youngest person there, I'd have a responsibility to get everyone out safely in the event of a shooting incident, and honestly, I'm just too tired. Okay, this is the last one. It's a quick one. More about real estate. Also for McSweeney's, this just came out last month. I feel like I should have one of those little Netflix things going across the bottom that says any relation to real people or places is strictly coincidental. Big wink. I wrote this after spending a lot of time in school board meetings. And it's called The Only Way to Save Public Education is to Turn Every Single School in America into High-End Condos. I hear a lot of pie-in-the-sky utopian BS about education and equity and having an actual building that shields children from the elements. But when will parents and bleeding-heart liberals realize that the only way to save public education in this country is to turn every elementary, middle, and high school from Portland to San Francisco, from Pittsburgh to Iowa City, into high-end condos? How else can we be expected to handle HVAC upgrades, remove asbestos and lead water lines, and make much-needed improvements to accessibility? The sooner you realize the only way to make school buildings ADA compliant is to turn them into 8,000 per month luxury apartments, the faster we can all move forward. You wouldn't believe how much money developers are offering for those Art Deco pre-war and mid-mod era schools. You know how if you live in a gentrifying neighborhood, you get calls from people trying to con you out of your house for like 30% of market value? Well, guess what? Those guys are calling about schools too. And money talks, especially when it's 27.5% of market value and belongs to the public. K-12 Can't you see this makes sense? Can't you see shelves that currently hold children's Salto sculptures housing a whiskey collection? A flat screen in place of the All About Me pinboard? Pelotons in the school gym instead of overflow music and social studies classes? Don't worry. Many kids will get pulled out for private schools or charters, or their parents will say, well, I guess we're moving to the burbs. The kids left behind, we'll toss them in some trailers on a brownfield. They'll be fine. And honestly, why should we care if their own parents can't be bothered to pull them out of a failing district? Plus, the 25% of market value that the developers pay goes straight into public school coffers. That's some serious trailer money. You don't like progress? You don't like better public schools because we've closed the public schools that we're taking so many resources? Let's see you balance a school district's budget without turning all its buildings into elegant townhomes. No, you're being impractical. It's not like the buildings will disappear. Just instead of a school building that has belonged to the public for 9 decades, they'll be chic Euro-style flats for people with tech jobs. You'll still see them every day on your commute to an overpriced parochial school of a faith you don't share. And you can marvel at the way the developers preserved the building's sense of playfulness by incorporating a bespoke beer pong table in the kindergarten herb garden and turning the playground into a climbing gym. The buildings will act as a monument for something that used to be publicly owned and dedicated to America's future, but is now and forever dedicated to sleek marble countertops and 1, 2, and 3-bedroom floor plans. Please don't act like this won't benefit the youth. Where else are 23-year-olds with CEO fathers going to live? I don't get why you're so upset about this. It's clear. If every school building in America is not turned into opulent private studios, urban maisonettes, or at the very minimum, vibrant live workspaces, American public education will fail. You don't want it to fail, do you? To fix the public education problem now and forever, we simply have to transform every public school in the nation into a self-supporting, exclusive, high-class, upscale, artisanally retrofit private oasis with top-notch resort-style amenities and an elevated boutique feel. Anyway, we're in talks to sell the entirety of American public school buildings as a lot for a cool 19% of market value. Don't worry, you don't need to vote on this. It's pretty much a done deal. Public education is saved. Thank you.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Thank you, Hallie. Fred Shaw was, in fact, named Emerging Poet Laureate finalist for Allegheny County in 2020. He is a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh, of Carlo University, where he received his MFA. He is now, I love this, he is now visiting lecturer of creative writing at the University of Pittsburgh. Yay! He curates the PQ feature in Pittsburgh Quarterly, poetry feature in Pittsburgh Quarterly. And he also, in case you haven't noticed, he also reviews books very deftly, with real grace. His first collection, Scraping Away, a wonderful book, was published by Cavan Carey Press. His second collection, I hear, is forthcoming. Please welcome Fred Shaw.
I think that works. Cool. All right. Hey, for all of you that came out tonight, I greatly appreciate just seeing a lot of friendly, familiar faces and just, you know, I think we all appreciate having an audience. So thank you. Thanks to Joan and Chris for all of your tireless efforts, keeping Hemingway's humming and just being such a top-notch reading series that just embodies so much of what Pittsburgh and poetry and the writing community is all about. So gratitude to you folks, to Don as well, for everything that he's doing. So I'm just going to read a couple from my book and then move into some new things and go from there. So the first poem I'm going to read is actually, I was going to read something else, but the person that I kind of dedicated it to didn't show up, so they're not going to have a poem read for them. But as Don and I were talking a little bit, he reminded me of this poem. So it's called Punk. I keep embarrassment in a stash, stacked and piled like yellowed news in cracked plaster rooms, off behind the kitchen table of my mind, a place to visit my drunken faux pas, file away the fuck-ups, and feel bad about the time I hit an old woman in the mouth with a jar full of maraschino cherries. Sometimes I thumb through to that time when Leo and I were 16, and we sat parked for hours in front of the Electric Banana. A punk club will never go inside. Out of fear, our night might end with a busted nose from a swirling mosh pit full of knees. Our missed chance to stomp and bleed and on a sticky dance floor still jangles like loose change in a pocket full of sad attempts to fit in. But it's only after Leo's blonde hair is lost to glue and malt liquor in a botched attempt at dreadlocks, after he buzzed it close to the skull and we lose touch, that I'll come to know so well those minor threat cassettes that click in a dusty Delco tape deck while we watch the Iron City punks loiter about the Banana's front door in their comfortable mohawks and effortless combat boots. Marooned and sober behind a foggy windshield, a lush hillside fails to take shape, and I find that, decades later, I am a cell full of deeds undone, going places where so much is an idling Chevy with a paint job the color of contusion. And this next one's for my wife, who I'm just grateful for every day. Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans? By the time that plate shatters its jagged slice from my hand, and medics kick apart our rotted French doors, hoping they can staunch the flow before rolling us, red-lit and howling across Canal Street, we'll find our days numbered in the city, gritty with want, blaming the hooch and yayo for leaving us raw-scraped and licking our lips numb on another as another dawn inches its way over. It was something to first feel the way heat climbs into every fold here, the pavement sizzling while a sax man sweats through another sugary cover, busking on sidewalks hosed down each morning after being painted by tourists ripped from the potent rum slush plied on every corner. When we skip town, all we leave of ourselves adds up to carnival beads and bloodstains, an unpaid lease, that neighbor's Hoover we borrowed, then broke. And in the quarter's wet cement, our initials still drying. So besides some of these poems that maybe some folks haven't heard before, this is actually the first time I'm going to actually wear glasses in public because, you know, that type of thing happens, and I'm up here like squinting away like, you do have a tool for that. So we'll give this a try. So I suspect, like some of you folks, going out to see live music can be an awful lot of fun. One of the more fun things, not only the live music, but it's the people watching, which can oftentimes be really interesting. So a few years ago, my wife and I were at the Byam Theater for a show by the Brooklyn band called Antibolus. Great band if you haven't checked it out. So the title is At the Antibolus Afrobeat Concert, Byam Theater, Pittsburgh. On a Wednesday night, all it takes to make latecomers scurry is a 12-piece rumbling to life. Bouncing notes all over this polished wood palace, decked in marble stairs and brass rails, where grooves begin as thrum beneath dimming house lights, and an oldster sits front row, sporting the faded jeans and white sneakers worn in Elks clubs everywhere. He nods along, ball-capped and cirrus-haired, fist-pumping to bass lines with blue-eyed delight, in a hall full of toes tapping. When the band strikes first chords in its song about greed, he's the only one who stands. Rocking to the beat on stiff-bowed legs, right hand held aloft, winding his way up polyrhythm's river, until an usher cups her palms to his ear, asks him to be seated. Instead, he draws sawbucks from his pocket, wads them with joy, each toss delivered towards stage, graceful and arcing as an ephus. For anyone that's unfamiliar with an ephus, it's a baseball pitch. It's like a big lobbed pitch. So, sorry, probably should have pointed that out. I bike to class, and especially whenever I was teaching downtown, for some reason, I love alleyways. I don't know what it is about dumpsters. And just some of the weird stuff, the graffiti, people hanging out, and oftentimes cutting through Springway, I would see people that were out catching a smoke, having coffee, whatever. Restaurant workers typically like myself, and so I thought those folks deserved a poem. So it's called Shift Meeting. Shift meeting is the thing that happens before your restaurant shift and is basically the most useless waste of time ever. But nevertheless, it often feels like it just needs to be done. One sparrow crow hops around a toss of stale Mancini's as apron servers ready for another night's dinner surge, a clutch of them crouching above warm asphalt, dishing among the stink of three-day-old fish, rimming this alleyway behind Roland's, the ooze from the dumpster topping one pothole until it's a milky cataract, blurring the echo of blue-eyed sky granted this narrow track. Blowing clouds of smoke, they wait for the pissy chef to show with his clipboard, while just inside, a party of fussy-faced women wait to be seated. Their checks will be separate. Their needs all hurry. One of the great things, thank you, folks. One of the great things about working in restaurants is not only just getting to be around food and drink as things that I love quite a bit, but actually it's about the people. Not only the people that you wait on, but the people that you work with, the people that you kind of come across. So I've found that I've just been writing a lot about people over the past few years. And so Keith Stebler is our longtime piano player at Revival on Lincoln, where I currently work. And I just felt that Keith, who's about that tall and is in the Pittsburgh Jazz Hall of Fame, deserved a poem. So this is for Keith. The Subtle Art of Dinner Music. Even as another purpled sunset curtains this bistro's leaded windows, letting dinner talk turn to hush while we pour red wine with a burble, none of us can recall when our glass-eyed piano man became the lucky piece we fist bump at the threshold. Tonight, with one hearing aid gone to shit, he sips another cold coffee, cocking his head toward a speaker, streaming some ballad he'll name in a grumble, hailing us with swollen knuckles before asking for one of our black sleeves, letting us guide him like a grounded songbird, his free hand a wing searching for the gray edge of his coddled Casio, tucked and waiting for his touch among the velvet wallpaper and roasted garlic perfuming the air. Though some dub this gig as crowd control, it'll take him fiddling a speaker wire to catch a bark of feedback before Stormy comes greased from the keys, its melody ushering one husband to whisper into his wife's ear, making her giggle as he reaches to cup her warm hand in his own. Mostly, our soloists resist the old mantra, the faster you play, the faster they eat. In favor of mid-tempo numbers, bantering with the crowd while we clear plates and top waters before he strolls through standards and show tunes muddled with age. The stopper, a dusty Hello Dolly, arriving on schedule, his thin voice straining to channel the gravel of Satchmo, tip jar flurried with five spots. After midnight, when the place empties, a bag of leftovers swings on his forearm as he white canes his way across Lincoln Avenue. The light blinking orange, the magnet of wherever it is he calls home, pulling him through the October air. All of us warmed by what we've downed together. Another stray bottle left open to breathe. I'm just going to wrap up with two new poems. This one I've never actually read before, so we'll see how it goes. It's for my dad. Peaches. By night, Dad would settle ugly into his favorite silence, letting his lit cigarette grow its long ash until our living room became dusted with finger trails. His long slide beginning cross-legged on the love seat, book in lap, the front door stickered with a pint-sized flag declaring, love it or leave it. And like a red-tailed hawk, spread-winged and keening just above the pitched roofs in Pittsburgh, his birth month passes, wrapped in this foggy heat, making long days river into a bruised brandywine, the spider-spun drag line, one forehead prickled with sweat, that I'll guilt over buying a half peck of freestones, their thin skin the color of sunset, is to recall those last months when all he could do was mouth for a sticky last bite, as if half a Red Haven palming its creamy yellow flesh would have been enough to save him from February frosting over his hospital windows, a place where all to be had was a memory of his from long ago, a bowl of milky cornflakes floating with all he might have needed to steal him for what had followed. And this last poem is for my mom, which I did get to talk to her on Mother's Day. That just passed, but somehow this poem goes from her to being about me, but nevertheless. In the waiting room at St. Clair Hospital. Left arm wrapped and slinged, mom scrawling her family history half aloud. Up against a receptionist yawns in the buttery voice of a TV blonde ogling a colonial's oak beams. The office air does little to cool what can't be undone. The squalling call last Friday, the ambulance's angry red flash, the snap of a ring finger she still hears in her sleep. The surgeon details all the pins and screws to be sunk, the incision that'll fall where a gold band once swelled her knuckle, his shop talk reminding me how it took both hands for mom to mend what dad wouldn't when he was in his cups. Teaching me in the process how little holds for long. Lingering beneath its humming violet light, she combed his cluttered workbench, peeling parts from wrecked model planes, cobbling a tilting windmill from a yellow propeller and balsa scrap, the glue drying into pearls beneath a herd of toy box cows, grazing on a crayoned meadow, razored from another empty case of beer. Stooped now, she'll tread from PT toward the soft rumble of sliding doors, happy to unwind what sounds like a beloved bootleg, fragile on cassette. The rhapsody of that long ago day, warm as her water breaking at the five and dime. The whistle stop of a traffic cop playing over the tonic of Dad's sweet nothings, whispered as he must have on a gridlocked Hope Hollow road, where a siren's diminished fifth guides them towards my first breaths, coming in this place where her favorite story always ends with a pink-faced solo, never failing to find its bloom. Thank you, folks.
That was so great! Yes!
Thank you to all of our poets and writers. We had satire, we had nonfiction, we had poetry tonight. Wow! I want to just mention that there is a... we have a long tradition with in the Hemingway series of making sure that we... remember the waitstaff who are so important. Yes. And tonight, and I think probably in 2 weeks too, those folks will be Herb and Carly, who greeted you perhaps when you came in. There is a jar over here. We'll have to figure out what to do because we used to pass a basket. And we forgot about the basket. So if you, we'd encourage you to leave something for the waitstaff and be mindful that they're here, you know, they're here just because it's such a great place to be, but they also have to earn a living. And I want to tell you who's reading in 2 weeks. Now remember, we're going every other Tuesday. So if you come back here next Tuesday, there'll be something else happening. It will not be us. But on May the 28th, our readers will be Cameron Barnett, Christina Fisanik, Shannon Sankey, Jason Irwin, who is here tonight, and Byron Hoot. So that will be wonderful. And we'd really like to have you back for that. We're going to take a break. But there is an open mic sign up over here next to Fred, okay? And if you want, right there. And if you'd like to read, we have 5 spots, and the deal is 2 pages. And as Jimmy used to say, please don't try to read Hiawatha. Okay, I know Hiawatha tonight. And we're going to take a break so we can have the poets and writers come up for the group photo. You can look at the books. We can buy some books, schmooze, and then we'll come back for the open mic. And thank you all for being here for the kickoff of the 2024 Hemingway Summer Poetry Series. And a big thank you to Hop Farm. A big, big thank you to Hop Farm. And a big thank you to Chris, who is amazing. Chris, woo! And to Don Sterica, whom if you haven't met, you should go come up and chat him up a bit. And he is my partner, and he is the one who does the photograph and the audio, and he carries all this stuff here too. It's amazing. Okay, thank heavens. And the poets and writers who read tonight, right back here, right now.
Okay, we're doing this. It's been 4 years since we've done this, I think. 4 years since we've done an open mic at Hemingway's. So, our first reader is Jonathan Solomon. Come on down.
Okay, can you hear me? If you want to. Oh, how's that? Is that better? All right. The name of this, it's very short. So the name of the poem is Watching the Turquoise Sea, South Beach, Miami. Incessantly under curling breakers thunder the shore, as if pouring libations for the dead. It's right in your face, the white beard foam breathes, gods of the first great day. We creatures of land, crouching the beach, are exiled live in our flesh, the blood yearning for home. We carry each inside our own original bit of the sea. After climate unease, in overheated Promethean fires, we are all beachfront property, reclining in the rising tide. You wait in vain to behold Christ tread the waves here, or see them divide for the Moses swarm. How about Einstein or Oppenheimer riding in on a surfboard with wake field acceleration off Ulysses' Happy Isles? In the new myths of quantum theory, a particle is also a wave and can at once be the same there as here. But where were we in plenitude of the Paleozoic age? Now it's let's go to London, see cats.
Thank you. Next up, we've got Margaret Casper Reed.
Hi, thank you. So this is called Wild Heart. And I'll try it on the phone, and I hope I can read it. I think I can. So the heart's a wildflower, a wind-up toy, backdoor rug mud-splattered, a solitary farmhouse, reflected light sizzling on new-fallen snow. The heart's a jumbotron flashing at the bottom of the ninth. She buzzes, drunk, Velcroed to the center of sunflowers. She's sassy, she talks back, overtalks, doesn't think things through. The heart's the woman in the moon, contra soprano, hissed upon, hushed up, hurrahed, a woman of war, goddess aged, rank entangled. The heart's high tides floods, abandoning starfish to dank alleyways. The heart's a Mr. Softy truck, musicaling down Main Street. The heart's alone in the projection booth, splicing ancient reels together. The heart's acres of olives, the nets that capture them, and the bruised crush that comes later. The heart's bouquet is lavender mixed with junkyard stink. She's a screamer, that one, a screaming Mimi. And each time she clip-clop stomped on, her decibel levels womp over the legal limit for civilized society with a zing and a ping and a womp and a hammer, taking the heat and making it too. The heart's forged a golden shield, covered it with hieroglyphics. The heart never, ever leaves junior high school. Still sits in the third seat, watching dust particles fly up from the heater, waiting for notes, every piece of paper folded and unfolded, origami roots to ecstasy or despair. The heart's full of pink Play-Doh. The heart's a high jumper, a spangled circus star shot from the cannon. Don't blink. Watch this once-in-a-lifetime event. Oh, will she make it? The heart's a bloomin' idiot. Thinks the wind chiseled the president's faces on Mount Rushmore. The heart works part-time as a crash dummy, night custodian, private eye, air traffic controller, does time on the suicide hotline. With the heart, all the wagging fingers agree it's always high, high drama. Just ask around. Always a Hollywood opening. Searchlight scrolling night skies. The heart's a synchronized swimmer, a revolving door. The heart never, ever pauses for station identification, recalibration. The heart makes backroom deals in hushed tones with unsavory thugs in Russian saunas. The heart's spun glass crackling, spiral nebulas clanging, aurora borealis washing night skies green. The heart's a crock pot left on low simmer for centuries. The heart's turbocharged, a fifth-wheeled, a goony bird. The heart gets overtime for driving the bus on field trips, keeps an eye in the rearview mirror on the rebels in the way, way back. The heart's dreams melt in the front seat of the rusted Volkswagen, mix with butterscotch hard candies, yearbook pictures, love notes, eulogies, all fossilized to an opaque amber, worthy of a monument, a tomb of the unknown, and finally, unknowable. Our hearts, our wild, wild hearts. Thank you.
That was great, Margaret. Next up, we have a bon vivant, a man about town, the gentleman himself, Mr. Matt Yusia.
So does anybody know the Ernest Becker book, The Denial of Death? Came out in the 70s. Yeah, one guy, yes, right? This premise, like everything we do, all the crazy shit we do is just an attempt to, you know, have kids, write poetry, get graduate degrees in English, have really complicated opinions on craft beer. It's all just an attempt to deny that you're gonna die one day. So I'm working on a series of poems about all of those strategies called The Denial of Death Number Whatever. This poem is not about any of those strategies. This is called Denial of Death Number 99. Know that once in the spring of 1998, when I lived in an old house in the country, spent a rainy day listening with all the windows open to classical music records bought at an estate sale, the smell of rain and damp grass mixed with the Moonlight Sonata, it was the first time I thought I understood eternity. There were other moments in solitude, in intimacy, in crowds, pleasures of discovery, of aesthetics, and deadly sins. Times when my ribs tingled when I thought about love. Sometime after we are born, we become convinced something is supposed to happen to us. Spend our whole lives looking for a train that never arrives. Or realize decades later, a glimpse is all we are afforded. Thank you.
Our last reader tonight, Stuart James Schmidt.
I wasn't going to read anything tonight, but then Jan convinced me that I could do this on my phone, so I'll try it. We'll see how it goes. This is called Swan Song. I carved a path through the breaking asphalt in my cobalt blue 1987 convertible Camaro, high as I'd ever been, the shimmer of guitar behind me, and embers flying from the end of my cigarette. I would drive this car straight into the horizon with the unearthed beach behind me, sirens and the distant wail of the land I've torn apart, if I thought that it would lead me to you. Here with my sunflowers in their mason jar, here with my half-frozen handle of Old Crow, here in the memory palace I have built out of burnt CDs and stolen flowers, here as you return my clandestine call, the ember burns at the end of my unfiltered lucky strike mixed with marijuana. Here in this burnt-out shell of my youth, here in this garden or ruin, here where the specter of war still haunts the many young on their aimless pilgrimage, here where love could reign or battle lines could be drawn, here in the other country of our past, I have met you again, and this time for the last. There are two kinds of freedom, two disparate paths that divide and conquer each and every heart and mind met along the wandering trail. The first, of course, is the freedom for yourself, which culminates to something like self-actualization. The second is the freedom for another, which is little different from love. I and my effigy of you, you and your iconography, there before the burning silver nitrate and cast out hymn of the arsonist, my little pyre of dried flowers and your lilting lullaby on the mandolin. So this is goodbye. So this is how our world ends, not with a bang, but with your whispering declaration. I am free again. I have made my life and song and given to you my sacred tongue to speak in the language of God. I could not dare disturb the silence of your tearing stare or my first communion. I could not dare take another step, kiss your eyelid, and make you my possession. When people speak of love, they speak of an idealization. When people speak of freedom, they speak of an idealization. When I speak of love, I speak to you. When I speak of freedom, I speak to you. Where I shall find them for myself, I will speak of you. Where I shall go from here on out, it will be with you. Where I may find you now, I will find myself too. Where I may find you now, I will find the last bit of fight and flight before my signal fire comes crashing down into the ocean. Until then, I will try not to crash this machine into your haven again. Thank you.
Wow. And that's why we're so happy to have the open mic back. Yes. Yes. Just a reminder that in 2 weeks, just in case you, okay, in 2 weeks, Tuesday, May the 28th, Cameron Barnett, Christina Fasanik, Shannon Sankey, Jason Irwin, who is here, and Byron Hoot. And if for some reason you are not on the Pittsburgh Poetry eBlast, but might wish to receive notices of future events, no salesman will call. Just put your name and your email on the pad over there. And thank you, Chris. Thank you, John. And thank you all, and thanks to Hop Farm. Yay! See you in 2 weeks.